The Third Man by Graham Greene, read by Martin Jarvis. One never knows when the blow may fall. When I saw Rollo Martins first, I made this note on him for my security police files. In normal circumstances, a cheerful fool. Drinks too much and may cause a little trouble. Whenever a woman passes, raises his eyes and makes some comment. But I get the impression that really he'd rather not be bothered. Has never really grown up, and perhaps that accounts for the way he worshipped lime. I wrote there that phrase, in normal circumstances, because I met him first at Harry Lime's funeral. It was February, and the gravediggers had been forced to use electric drills to open the frozen ground in Vienna's central cemetery. It was as if even nature were doing its best to reject Lime, but we got him in at last and laid the earth back on him like bricks. He was vaulted in, and Rollo Martins walked quickly away as though his long gangly legs wanted to break into a run, and the tears of a boy ran down his 35-year-old face. Rollo Martins believed in friendship, and that was why what happened later was a worse shock to him than it would have been to you or me. You, because you would have put it down to an illusion, and me, because at once a rational explanation, however wrongly, would have come to my mind. If only he had come to tell me then, what a lot of trouble would have been saved. If you are to understand this strange, rather sad story, you must have an impression at least of the background. The smashed, dreary city of Vienna, divided up in zones among the four powers. The Russian, the British, the American, the French zones, regions marked only by notice boards. And in the centre of the city, surrounded by the ring with its heavy public buildings and its prancing statuary, the Innere Stadt, under the control of all four powers. In this once fashionable inner city, each power in turn, for a month at a time, takes, as we call it, the chair, and becomes responsible for security. At night, if you were fool enough to waste your Austrian shillings on a nightclub, you would be fairly certain to see the international power at work. Four military police, one from each power, communicating with each other, if they communicated at all, in the common language of their enemy. I never knew Vienna between the wars, and I am too young to remember the old Vienna with its Strauss music and its bogus easy charm. To me, it is simply a city of undignified ruins, which turned that February into great glaciers of snow and ice. The Danube was a grey, flat, muddy river a long way off across the second Bezirk, the Russian zone where the Prater lay, smashed and desolate, and full of weeds. Only the great wheel revolving slowly over the foundations of merry-go-rounds like abandoned millstones, the rusting iron of smashed tanks which nobody had cleared away, the frost-nipped weeds where the snow was thin. I haven't enough imagination to picture it as it had once been, any more than I can picture Sacher's Hotel as other than a transit hotel for English officers, or see the Kärntnerstrasse as a fashionable shopping street, instead of a street which exists, most of it, only at eye level, repaired up to the first story. A Russian soldier in a fur cap goes by with a rifle over his shoulder. A few tarts cluster round the American Information Office, and men in overcoats sip ersatz coffee in the windows of the old Vienna. At night, it is just as well to stick to the inner city, or the zones of three of the powers, though even there the kidnappings occur. Such senseless kidnappings they sometimes seem to us. A Ukrainian girl without a passport, an old man beyond the age of usefulness. Sometimes, of course, the technician, or the traitor. This was roughly the Vienna to which Rollo Martins came on February the 7th last year. I have reconstructed the affair as best I can from my own files and from what Martins told me. It is as accurate as I can make it. I've tried not to invent a line of dialogue, though I can't vouch for Martins' memory. An ugly story, if you leave out the girl. Grim and sad and unrelieved, if it were not for that absurd episode of the British Council lecturer. A British subject can still travel if he is content to take with him only £5, which he is forbidden to spend abroad. But if Rollo Martins had not received an invitation from Lime of the International Refugee Office, he would not have been allowed to enter Austria, which counts still as occupied territory. Lyme had suggested that Martins might write up the business of looking after the international refugees, and although it wasn't Martin's usual line, he had consented. It would give him a holiday, and he badly needed a holiday after the incident in Dublin and the other incident in Amsterdam. He always tried to dismiss women as incidents, things that simply happened to him without any will of his own, acts of God in the eyes of insurance agents. He had a haggard look when he arrived in Vienna, and a habit of looking over his shoulder that for a time made me suspicious of him, until I realized that he went in fear that one of, say, six people might turn up unexpectedly. He told me vaguely that he had been mixing his drinks. That was another way of putting it. Rollo Martin's usual line was the writing of cheap paper-covered westerns under the name of Buck Dexter. His public was large but unremunerative. He couldn't have afforded Vienna if Lyme had not offered to pay his expenses when he got there, out of some vaguely described propaganda fund. Lyme could also, he said, keep him supplied with paper buffs, the only currency in use from a penny upwards in British hotels and clubs. So it was with exactly 5 unusable pound notes that Martins arrived in Vienna. An odd incident had occurred at Frankfurt, where the plane from London grounded for an hour. Martins was eating a hamburger in the American canteen. A kindly airline supplied the passengers with a voucher for 65 cents worth of food, when a man he could recognize from 20 feet away as a journalist approached his table. "You Mr. Dexter?" he asked. "Yes," Martins said, taken off his guard. "You look younger than your photographs," the man said. "Like to make a statement? I represent the local forces paper here. We'd like to know what you think of Frankfurt." "I only touched down 10 minutes ago." "Fair enough," the man said. "What about views on the American novel?" "I don't read them," Martins said. "The well-known acid humour," the journalist said. He pointed at a small grey-haired man with protruding teeth, nibbling a bit of bread. "Happen to know if that's Carey?" "No. What Carey?" "J.G. Carey, of course." "I've never heard of him." "You novelists live out of the world. He's my real assignment." And Martins watched him make across the room for the great Carey, who greeted him with a false headline smile, laying down his crust. Dexter wasn't the man's assignment, but Martins couldn't help feeling a certain pride. Nobody had ever before referred to him as a novelist. And that sense of pride and importance carried him over the disappointment when Lyme was not there to meet him at the airport. We never get accustomed to being less important to other people than they are to us. Martins felt the little jab of dispensability, standing by the bus door watching the snow come sifting down so thinly and softly that the great drifts among the ruined buildings had an air of permanence, as though they were not the result of this meagre fall, but lay forever above the line of perpetual snow. There was no Lyme to meet him at the Hotel Astoria, the terminus where the bus landed him, and no message, only a cryptic one for Mr. Dexter, from someone he had never heard of, called Crabbin. "We expected you on tomorrow's plane. Please stay where you are. On the way round. Hotel room booked." But Rollo Martins wasn't the kind of man who stayed around. If you stayed around in a hotel lounge, sooner or later incidents occurred. One mixed one's drinks. I can hear Rollo Martins saying to me, "I've done with incidents. No more incidents," before he plunged head first into the most serious incident of all. There was always a conflict in Rollo Martins between the absurd Christian name and the sturdy Dutch, 4 generations back, surname. Rollo looked at every woman that passed, and Martins renounced them forever. I don't know which one of them wrote the westerns. Martins had been given Lyme's address, and he felt no curiosity about the man called Crabbin. It was too obvious that a mistake had been made, though he didn't yet connect it with the conversation at Frankfurt. Lyme had written that he could put Martins up in his own flat, a large apartment on the edge of Vienna that had been requisitioned from a Nazi owner. Lyme could pay for the taxi when he arrived, so Martins drove straight away to the building lying in the 3rd British zone. He kept the taxi waiting while he mounted to the 3rd floor. How quickly one becomes aware of silence, even in so silent a city as Vienna, with the snow steadily settling. Martins hadn't reached the 2nd floor before he was convinced that he would not find Lyme there. but the silence was deeper than just absence. It was as if he would not find Lime anywhere in Vienna, and as he reached the third floor and saw the big black bow over the door handle, anywhere in the world at all. Of course, it might have been a cook who had died, a housekeeper, anybody but Harry Lime. But he knew, he felt he had known 20 stairs down, that Lime, the Lime he had hero-worshipped now for 20 years, since the first meeting in a grim school corridor with a cracked bell ringing for prayers, was gone. Martins wasn't wrong, not entirely wrong. After he had rung the bell 6 times, a small man with a sullen expression put his head out from another flat and told him in a tone of vexation, "It's no use. There's nobody there. He's dead." "Herr Lime?" "Herr Lime, of course." Martin said to me later, "At first it didn't mean a thing. It was just a bit of information, like those paragraphs in the Times they call news in brief." I said to him, "When did it happen? How?" "He was run over by a car," the man said. "Last Thursday." He added sullenly, as if really this were none of his business, "They're burying him this afternoon. You've only just missed them." "Them? Oh, a couple of friends, and the coffin." "Wasn't he in hospital?" "There was no sense in taking him to hospital. He was killed here on his own doorstep, instantaneously. The right-hand mudguard struck him on his shoulder and bowled him over like a rabbit." "It was only then," Martins told me, "when the man used the word rabbit, that the dead Harry Lime came alive, became the boy with the gun which he had shown Martins the means of borrowing, a boy starting up among the long sandy burrows of Brickworth Common, saying, 'Shoot, you fool, shoot, there!' And the rabbit limped to cover, wounded by Martins' shot." "Where are they burying him?" he asked the stranger on the landing. "In the central cemetery. They'll have a hard time of it in this frost." He had no idea how to pay for his taxi, or indeed where in Vienna he could find a room in which he could live for 5 English pounds. But that problem had to be postponed until he had seen the last of Harry Lime. He drove straight out of town into the suburb, British zone, where the central cemetery lay. One passed through the Russian zone to reach it, and took a short cut through the American zone, which you couldn't mistake because of the ice cream parlours in every street. The trams ran along the high wall of the central cemetery, and for a mile on the other side of the rails stretched the monumental masons and the market gardeners, an apparently endless chain of gravestones waiting for owners and wreaths waiting for mourners. Martins had not realized the size of this huge snowbound park where he was making his last rendezvous with Lime. It was as if Harry had left a message for him, "Meet me in Hyde Park," without specifying a spot between the Achilles statue and Lancaster Gate. The avenues of graves, each avenue numbered and lettered, stretched out like the spokes of an enormous wheel. They drove for 1/2 mile towards the west, and then turned and drove 1/2 mile north, turned south. The snow gave the great pompous family headstones an air of grotesque comedy. A toupee of snow slipped sideways over an angelic face. A saint wore a heavy white moustache, and a shako of snow tipped at a drunken angle over the bust of a superior civil servant called Wolfgang Gottman. Even this cemetery was zoned between the powers. The Russian zone was marked by huge, tasteless statues of armed men, the French by rows of anonymous wooden crosses and a torn, tired tricolour flag. Then Martins remembered that Lime was a Catholic and was unlikely to be buried in the British zone, for which they had been vainly searching. So back they drove, through the heart of a forest where the graves lay like wolves under the trees, winking white eyes under the gloom of the evergreens. Once, from under the trees, emerged a group of 3 men in strange 18th-century black and silver uniforms with 3-cornered hats, pushing a kind of barrow. They crossed a ride in the forest of graves and disappeared again. It was just chance that they found the funeral in time. 1 patch in the enormous park where the snow had been shoveled aside, and a tiny group was gathered, apparently bent on some very private business. A priest had finished speaking, his words coming secretively through the thin, patient snow, and a coffin was on the point of being lowered into the ground. 2 men in lounge suits stood at the graveside. One carried a wreath that he obviously had forgotten to drop onto the coffin, for his companion nudged his elbow so that he came to with a start and dropped the flowers. A girl stood a little way away with her hands over her face, and I stood 20 yards away by another grave, watching with relief the last of Lyme, and noticing carefully who was there. Just a man in a Macintosh, I was to Martin's. He came up to me and said, "Could you tell me who they're burying?" "A fellow called Lyme," I said, and was astonished to see the tears start to this stranger's eyes. He didn't look like a man who wept, nor was Lyme the kind of man whom I thought likely to have mourners, genuine mourners with genuine tears. There was the girl, of course, but one accepts women from all such generalizations. Martins stood there till the end, close beside me. He said to me later that, as an old friend, he didn't want to intrude on these newer ones. Lyme's death belonged to them. Let them have it. He was under the sentimental illusion that Lyme's life, 20 years of it anyway, belonged to him. As soon as the affair was over, I'm not a religious man and always feel a little impatient with the fuss that surrounds death, Martins strode away on his long legs, which always seemed likely to get entangled together, back to his taxi. He made no attempt to speak to anyone, and the tears now were really running, at any rate the few meager drops that any of us can squeeze out at our age. One's file, you know, is never quite complete. A case is never really closed, even after a century, when all the participants are dead. So I followed Martins. I knew the other three. I wanted to know the stranger. I caught him up by his taxi and said, "I haven't any transport. Would you give me a lift into town?" "Of course," he said. I knew the driver of my jeep would spot me as we came out and follow us unobtrusively. As we drove away, I noticed Martins never looked behind. It's nearly always the fake mourners and the fake lovers who take that last look, who wait waving on platforms instead of clearing quickly out, not looking back. Is it perhaps that they love themselves so much and want to keep themselves in the sight of others, even of the dead? I said, "My name's Calloway." "Martins," he said. "You were a friend of Lyme?" "Yes." Most people in the last week would have hesitated before they admitted quite so much. "Been here long?" "I only came this afternoon from England. Harry had asked me to stay with him. I hadn't heard." "Bit of a shock?" "Look here," he said. "I badly want a drink, but I haven't any cash except £5 sterling. I'd be awfully grateful if you'd stand me one." It was my turn to say, "Of course." I thought for a moment and told the driver the name of a small bar in the Kärntnerstrasse. I didn't think he'd want to be seen for a while in a busy British bar full of transit officers and their wives. This bar, perhaps because it was exorbitant in its prices, seldom had more than one self-occupied couple in it at a time. The trouble was, too, that it really only had one drink, a sweet chocolate liqueur that the waiter improved at a price with cognac. But I got the impression that Martins had no objection to any drink, so long as it cast a veil over the present and the past. On the door was the usual notice saying the bar opened from 6 till 10, but one just pushed the door and walked through the front rooms. We had a whole small room to ourselves. The only couple were next door, and the waiter, who knew me, left us alone with some caviar sandwiches. It was lucky that we both knew I had an expense account. Martin said, over his second quick drink, "I'm sorry, but he was the best friend I ever had." I couldn't resist saying, knowing what I knew, and because I was anxious to vex him, one learns a lot that way, "That sounds like a cheap novelette." He said quickly, "I write cheap novelettes." I had learned something anyway. Until he had had a third drink, I was under the impression that he wasn't an easy talker, and I felt fairly certain he was one of those who'd turn unpleasant after their fourth glass. I said, "Tell me about yourself and Lyme." "Look here," he said. "I badly need another drink, but I can't keep on scrounging on a stranger. Could you change me a pound or two into Austrian money?" "Don't bother about that," I said, and called the waiter. "You can treat me when I come to London on leave. You were going to tell me how you met Lyme?" The glass of chocolate liqueur might have been a crystal, the way he looked at it and turned it this way and that. He said, "It was a long time ago. I don't suppose anyone knows Harry the way I do. and I thought of the thick file of agents' reports in my office.